So quite a journey through the Satipatthana Sutta. The Buddha's primary teaching on mindfulness. And I think, as we've seen, it just contains an awful lot of Dharma, a lot of teaching. So if you like, the perspective of the Dharma and awareness meet. And I think that's what gives the sutta its power, really. It's encouraging us to see things in the light of the Dharma, of all these different teachings, and in the context of awareness, of body, of feeling, and mind. And then the last few weeks we've been looking at different Dharma perspectives, different ways of viewing our experience through the lens of different Dharma teachings. So this is the final section of the Dhammas section on the Four Noble Truths. One of the earliest teachings that the Buddha gave, the Four Noble Truths, I had intended to write it up on the board and I didn't quite get it together. So we have these four, this sequence, this conditional sequence of events, so or things. So we have dukkha. We have dukkha, which can be translated in many different ways, and I'll go into some of the translations. But dis-ease or suffering, dukkha arising in dependence upon craving, upon wanting. So craving is the second of the Four Noble Truths, and then dukkha ceasing, the third noble truth, independence upon craving ceasing, dukkha, or dis-ease, suffering ceases. And then the fourth noble truth, the path to the cessation of craving and dukkha through the Noble Eightfold Path. So this evening, I'm not going to talk much about the third and the fourth, about cessation and the Noble Eightfold Path. I want to talk much more about the qualities of dukkha and tanha, craving, or lobha, craving, and the sort of interrelationship between the two, how one is embedded in the other in many, many different ways. And if you like, the training is to become aware of that interaction between dukkha and tanha, between craving or dis-ease and wanting, desire. And seeing these things clearly leads us to the other, well, it certainly leads us to cessation, the third one. So I think recognizing dukkha, recognizing craving, can be a whole path. I've come across someone who has treated it pretty much as the whole path, and his path is really just turning towards whenever he notices there's discomfort, dis-ease, dissatisfaction, noticing that, relating to that, and seeing what's going on. And where craving and wanting comes in is often there's a desire when dukkha is there, when dis-ease is there, there's a desire for it to be otherwise. That's where the desire is coming in, the wanting or the craving is coming in, a desire for something to be different, for it not to be like this or to be like that. So there's a sort of complaint or an argument with how things are. And it's not fair, or it shouldn't be like that, or I want it to be like that. There's many, many variations. So this person, his whole path was just looking in a very kindly way, a very sort of open way to what was happening, what was happening when there was discomfort or dis-ease, and seeing what the mind was doing around that, bringing a lot of awareness to it. So Bhante Sangharakshita talks about dukkha. He says it's a feeling, not an idea. So Buddhism being based on a feeling, a felt experience of when we feel discomfort, dis-ease, or suffering, or not liking something. We know what that feels like. We all know that experience. We don't have to sort of get philosophical about it or necessarily get existential about it. We know what it's like if something happens that we don't want. So Bhante says, dukkha is a feeling, it's not an idea, it's a felt experience. And then he goes on to say, it's only our infatuation with sense pleasures that prevents us from seeing it clearly, from seeing dukkha clearly. So I think it's put quite strongly, but I think it's quite interesting. It's only our infatuation with sense pleasures that stops us from seeing what's really happening, stops us from seeing what's going on around dis-ease. So dukkha has a bit of a bad press, and I must say when I was thinking about what I was going to say, I kept wanting to cheer it up a bit. I kept thinking, oh no, it's going to be too depressing, which is actually not my experience. I don't find it depressing. I find it inspiring, the idea of really understanding how my own responses are creating suffering, how my own way of relating to my experience is keeping me sort of caught and not free. So hopefully you won't find it too much of a downer, all this talk about suffering. So the word dukkha, which I'll go into to what is dukkha and the different types of dukkha, and then I'm going to go more or less the same thing on craving, what's the different types of tanha or craving, and then say a few things about how they interact, and a couple of different stories and teachings from the tradition that I think illuminates slightly different language. So dukkha comes from two different roots of words, du meaning bad or difficult, and ka, which means empty of anything substantial. And it's usually likened to a wheel, an ill-fitting chariot wheel, a wheel that will give you a bit of a rough ride. Because it's not very smooth. So this is quite a metaphor for life, I think, that it's not necessary. It's a bit of a bumpy ride at times. There's the rough with the smooth. At the very least, there's some rough with the smooth. And obviously, different people have different sort of configurations. They may have much more smooth than they have rough. But generally, the human condition is such that we all have some rough and we all have some smooth. So the ka, this word that means empty. So dukkha is put in terms of, in a way that the sort of unhappiness that this experience is empty of a substantial self, empty of something that we can sort of really rely on or have stay secure or stay the same. So there's a sort of instability in that rough ride, if you like, We never know quite when the wheel's going to fall off. So dukkha has those sorts of connotations. But in terms of a translation, the Pali Dictionary has this to say. It says, no single word covers the meaning of dukkha. Modern words are usually too specialised, too limited, or too strong. So I'll just give you an example of some of the words that are used, which come under these things. So disease rather than dis-ease. Pain or sorrow come under the limited. Pain is usually associated with a physical response, and sorrow is usually much more mental, whereas dukkha encapsulates both. And the words that are too strong sometimes talked about in terms of misery or distress or woe. So it suggests, and the various sort of interpretations of the words suggest things like dis-ease or stress. There's a certain stressfulness in life. Or unsatisfying, unreliable, incomplete. And it's not saying that all of life is like this. Just that there is dukkha. It's not that dukkha is all there is, but there is dukkha. It's really obvious. Of course that's true. Of course there's that. But we can live our lives as if we're surprised when difficult things happen or bad things happen. And there's a desire to get back onto the smooth as quickly as possible. So we might, if you like, have an intellectual understanding of rough and smooth. Dukkha happens, but when it happens, often we're a bit unprepared and not able to take it with as much equanimity as if we really believed it, if we really understood dukkha. So something that's quite important about it is that it's not inherent in phenomena, in things, but it's very much about how we relate to things, how we relate to experience. So meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein says, all conditioned things are unsatisfying ultimately, but whether or not they cause suffering depends on our relationship to them. And that relationship is usually connected with craving. It's usually a relationship of wanting something or not wanting something. And wanting and not wanting are two aspects of craving. They're two sides of the same coin. So by understanding dukkha, by really coming to see it for what it is, the Buddha says we can bring mental suffering to an end, completely to an end. And our relationship to physical suffering completely changes. The same experience no longer causes us suffering. So there's a lot of potential in understanding, coming to understand and to really know dukkha or dis-ease. So there are a few different types of dukkha. The first one is called dukkha-dukkha, which I find quite funny. So dukkha-dukkha is about there's quite a lot to do with the way that we experience the world. So the things that cause us discomfort and dis-ease in our lives. So, you know, pain, illness, discomfort. On the whole, we are pretty cushioned in the West, in our culture. We're pretty cushioned from, and we're quite good at managing discomfort that a lot of the world experience in a much greater way than we do. So to a certain extent, we can minimize, we can create comfort, but at a certain point, it breaks through. At a certain point, sort of illness happens, sickness happens, relationships break down, we go through financial hardship. There are many, many ways that suffering or discomfort, dis-ease manifests. We suffer through our own mental states. We suffer through our own sort of tendencies. We get angry with someone and then they give it back to us, you know. Or we feel upset because we've spoken unskillfully. So there are many, many ways in which... If you see dukkha as... not having some sort of equilibrium, some sort of being okay with how things are, including how we are. There are many, many ways that dukkha manifests. The Buddha, birth is dukkha, death is dukkha. So dukkha, it doesn't just happen to us, it happens to the people that we care about. And in the world, it manifests as the suffering of war, violence, hunger, oppression. It's not necessarily our experience, but as I said, it is for many, many, many people in the world. And it is quite easy for us to perhaps not appreciate that because we've been born into this unprecedented period of peace and prosperity. We all know nothing but that if we were brought up in the West over the last 70 years. But there's a book that I read a number of years ago by an author I like very much, Barbara Kingsolver, and the book is called The Poisonwood Bible. And so it's about, it's loosely based on her own experiences of growing up as the child of teachers working in the Congo, but the story is actually about a family of father is a missionary in the Congo. Great story, but the point I want to bring out here is the characters, apart from the missionary and his wife and their children. I think they have five children. They live completely amongst the local community, and they also live within a time of war. And at some point I realized all the characters that she was describing, all the black characters, the local characters, were all scarred in some way. The impact of their life was very visible. Maybe they were missing a limb from a mine, or they were scarred from machete blows from the war, or they were limping from an infection that there hadn't been medicine to treat. So they all sort of wore the dukkha of their lives on their bodies in a very, very visible way, in which we tend not to. We tend not to be able to see that. And that was a very natural feature of life. So that's dukkha. And then there's I haven't got the official categories for the others, so I'm just going to talk about different aspects of them. So the unreliable nature of things, so the impermanence of things that creates suffering through us wanting the things that we like to continue and the things that we don't like, wanting them to disappear as quickly as possible. So we don't understand, we don't really understand deeply that things are not dependent upon our wants or the way we want them. Things arise in dependence upon certain conditions, and if we really want something, that might influence the conditions. But really, something doesn't happen just because we want it, but because the causes and conditions support it happening. But that unreliable nature of things, the not being able to rest secure. So there's a lot of instability or insecurity, which most of the time we may not notice. Another book that was made into a TV show this year, some of you may have seen The Handmaid's Tale on TV. So it's quite a sort of dystopian vision of society. The writer, Margaret Atwood, said two things about it. She was criticised for it being a bit too extreme, for things that couldn't possibly happen. So she said two things. She said one thing was she hadn't put anything in the book that hadn't already happened somewhere in the world, in some part of the world, in some society, in the Holocaust or in other things. So there was nothing that was in the realm of fantasy. And the second thing she said in relation to that criticism, she said, I was born in 1939. I was born the year that the Second World War started. I know that anything can happen. Anything can happen. And I thought that was a really, really helpful perspective. If we can remember that anything can happen at any time. Not to make us feel more sort of unstable or insecure, but if you like that's normal. It's normal that it's how things are, that things arise, things change. So to in a way help us not be so shocked or disturbed by or outraged. Had a lot of outrage, which I confess I've shared myself, in politics over the last couple of years. It's easy to be outraged. But with, I think it's a wisdom perspective, really, to remember that anything can happen at any time. So another aspect of dukkha, I hope that you're not feeling depressed by this point, I really do. It's called the burdensomeness of conditioned existence. So what it's pointing to is it takes quite a lot of work to keep ourselves going. And we might not experience that as difficult or tricky. But we do require quite a lot of looking after, don't we? When you think about it. We also require quite specific conditions to live in, not too hot, not too cold. We've got a few degrees. We need the oxygen level to be within a certain range. We're quite specific in what we need, external conditions. But internal conditions, we have to eat at least a couple of times a day. We have to keep drinking. We have to have bathrooms on hand. We have to dress and have clothes. We have to take a lot of looking after. And as we get older, it takes more. We take more looking after. I know for myself, I can't get away with not exercising. I now don't exercise. There's a bit of pleasure in it, but it's more that if I don't, then I'm get stiff and I ache, or injuries happen. So that the body just requires, there's a lot of looking after going on. A lot of work just to keep me going. Sometimes there's also quite a lot of work if we're feeling a bit low, you know, you're feeling a bit low, just getting out of bed in the morning, you know, it requires quite a bit of effort to keep going. So all different types of dukkha. The Bhante talks about one called existential dukkha. So it's the feeling that even when everything is going well, there can be a desire for more, or a desire for it to continue. A sense of, and knowing that it's not necessarily going to continue, that everything's going well. It's instability. It's a slightly different way of looking at that instability. There's a sutta called the Fire Sermon, and talks about the dukkha of sense experience. So in a way, it's back to dukkha, but it's talking about the world is burning. The Buddha goes, it's quite graphic. All is burning, and what is the all that is burning? The eye is burning, forms are burning, eye consciousness is burning, eye contact is burning. Also, whatever is felt as pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that arises with eye contact. That too is burning. What's he talking about? It's all burning. Burning with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So burning through, he's talking about the suffering that we create through not being wise. The suffering that, again, might be quite small things of the way that we interact with each other. The being less than skillful in our speech, or cutting somebody up on the road. There's just many, many ways in which our lack of wisdom creates suffering, creates burning through the different senses. So that's it for dukkha for the moment. I breathe a sigh of relief. I will go on to craving. Okay, I think some people are dukkha people and some people are craving people. I suspect that I'm more a craving sort of person in terms of what sort of interests you and what really fascinates you. So different sorts of craving. There's craving for sense desire. So it means that sense desire, pleasure, enjoyment naturally arises. And the Buddha is not saying don't enjoy. It's just natural. When we have a body, when we have, when we see pleasant sights, we hear pleasant sounds, we taste enjoyable things, then it's nice, it's pleasant, and we can appreciate that and enjoy that. But it's when sense desire or the pleasure of the senses is our main reference point. It's what sort of motivates us. It's what sort of guides us in our choices, rather than things like a sense of meaning, of ethical values. Altruism. Bhante talks about this type of sense desire as not being motivated by a need for pleasant sights, or perhaps a need for a wholesome meal or something. It's not a need, it's more something that's a symptom of an emotional lack or emotional emptiness. So we're trying to sort of fill a gap through piling through piling in the sense experience. So it's really about not making a god out of sense pleasures and having a life that's bigger than that, that's more meaningful, that has a more meaningful direction. Because sense pleasures are endless. And there's always... they don't satisfy. Ultimately, they don't satisfy. They can give a moment of satisfaction, but then the emptiness still needs filling. So it's really finding a much more reliable, more meaningful sense of satisfaction. So then there's craving for existence and craving for non-existence. And these are quite subtle. So what it's talking about a life that's not about indulgence and it's not about denial, if you like, or hedonism, eternalism on the one hand, or nihilism on the other hand. But I think more fundamentally than that, it's about how we lean into, with craving for existence, we're leaning into the next moment. We're looking towards what's happening in the future, anticipating something happening. Or with craving for non-existence, we're resisting what's actually happening, the moment that's there. Looking, And it's through not being quite sort of happy and satisfied where we are, just with what's happening, with what's actually happening, rather than leaning towards pulling away. And in a way, it's noticing that it's good to notice those desires to not quite be present, or for what's present to not quite be enough. To notice that lack, I think, is helpful to do that. If we didn't feel some sort of lack, if we felt completely satisfied, we wouldn't be here. If everything was absolutely fine, we wouldn't be on a spiritual path searching for a deeper sense of meaning, perhaps a deeper sense of connection. Feeling in tune in some way with the values. So hopefully... we're all in the right place, in the right place to further that sense of connection with deeper values. So hopefully it's becoming clear in moments there's some sort of relationship between this dukkha, dissatisfaction, and craving, desiring, wanting. And if you like, craving is our attempt to try and satisfy that dukkha, that lack in ourselves. But we're really looking in the wrong place. So I want to tell a couple of stories. One of them isn't from the tradition in which the Satipatthana Sutta comes at all. It comes from a sutta or sutra, so it's much later, called the White Lotus Sutra. Some of you may be familiar with it. And it's a story called the Parable of the Burning House. And it tells the story of a wealthy man living in a very big house with lots and lots of children, presumably quite a lot of wives as well, or something like that. So he has about 30 children, the story goes, and they're all inside. There's, because he's wealthy, they have a lot of very pleasant things to do, toys and things. And one day, his large house gets, there's a fire. I don't know how it starts. He gets this fire. And he's inside the house trying to call the children to leave, to go outside. But they're so involved with their toys that they don't hear him. They're very absorbed in what they're doing. They don't really take any notice. So he doesn't know what to do. You know, the fire is growing, and you know, it's a real danger. They're really in a lot of trouble. So what he does, he uses a skillful means, and he shouts to them. He says, "Children, I've got they're playing with a lot of sort of chariots. That seems to be the toy of pleasure. These mini sort of cars and things." He says, "I've got the best ones you've ever seen here, but you have to come outside and get them." So he basically tempts them out. He tempts them out with the promise of better and better toys for them to play with, these chariots. So they do. They do come out. What he does is he gets them all these wonderful chariots, but they're all the same. I think they've all been playing with very different ones. So Sangharakshita draws a lot out of this sutra, which I don't have time to go into. He really draws a lot out of it. But I'm just going to draw a few points out of it. So one is the children not seeing the danger. If you like, the house is burning all around them, and there's a parallel with us not seeing the danger, not seeing the dangers of living in our world, which is governed by our internal world, governed by greed, hatred, and delusion. By governed by these fires, these fuel of delusion, actually, particularly delusion. We are caught in our enjoyment of things. So that's when the point I was making before, the main frame of reference. If it's sense desire, then we're blind to the dangers around, the dangers. Bhante, apparently in the sutra, it also says the children are not only playing with the toys, but they're running to and fro. They're running about the house. They're not static. They're not staying in one place. And Bhante talks about this as a sort of restlessness. So it's not as if being absorbed in sense pleasures or things that we think are really, really important. Perhaps the disagreement that we had with somebody, the slight falling out, or that, oh, I must get to the shops before, you know, I must do this. Lots of things that we attach a lot of importance to, but in the bigger scheme of things, they're not that important. But we can run all over the place in pursuit of quite small things. So this restlessness of the children, it's like it's an expression of not being connected with a deeper satisfaction. There's a running and looking and for satisfaction, different toys, not quite finding it. So then the father uses these skillful means. He tempts them out. And the father is sort of representative of, if you like, our higher nature, a more mature nature. And with these new toys, the promise of new toys, he shows them new ways of being. That's what Bhante says it's pointing to. So maybe we have some new toys in the form of a meditation practice. Maybe we don't quite see them as toys, but more as tools. new sort of tools or ways of communicating, new ways of connecting with something deeper, that means that that restless pursuit of all sorts of things that are not so important, perhaps that settles down a bit, perhaps that dies down a bit. And perhaps the biggest toy of all is this big vision, sense of a big vision for life. So that's the parable of the burning house, just a little bit about it. If you get a chance to read it, Parables of Myths and Symbols, is that what it's called? Myths?
Parables, Myths and Symbols in the White Lotus Sutra.
In the White Lotus Sutra, yeah, yeah. It's probably in the library. There's all sorts of different parables within it. There's another story, I think I've just about got time to tell it, and this is a story from the Kula Dukkha Kanda Sutta, which translates apparently as the lesser mass of suffering, the lesser mass of dukkha. But it's about a king, called Bimbisara, who was an early follower of the Buddha. He was a patron of the Buddha. And one of the suttas tells a meeting between the Buddha and King Bimbisara. It's put differently. Sometimes it's a third party putting the question, and sometimes the question arises between the Buddha and Bimbisara. Who is the happiest? Who is the happiest? And Bimbisara apparently says, he says, well, you know, I've got my harem, my wives, my elephants, my goats. I've got my palaces and all the food I could possibly want. I've got this fine clothing. It, you know, I must be really happy. And so the Buddha says to him, says, okay. And as you'll know, the Buddha has next to nothing in those sorts of things. He doesn't have a he left his wife a long time before to practice. He doesn't have a harem. He doesn't have any elephants or even any goats. He has his robe, probably a spare robe, and he has his bowl. And he has access to medicine. And the most common form of medicine was cow's urine when it was needed. Not sure what it was good for, but it was probably one of those sort of cure-alls, kill or cure. So the Buddha said, okay, so can you sit still doing nothing for an hour and be perfectly happy, be content? And Bimbisara says, yeah, I think so. And so the Buddha says, okay, so could you sit all day? Without doing anything, just sitting and remain perfectly content and happy. Bimbisara looks a little bit doubtful. He says, I think so. And then the Buddha says, well, how about a week? Could you sit for a week, just perfectly content and happy? And Bimbisara says, no way. And so what to take from this? I mean, it may be completely obvious, but what the Buddha's pointing to is a happiness, a contentment that is not dependent on external things. He's actually completely independent in himself. Just his mind, he's able to work with his mind to such an extent that he's content with very little, and content just to be without anything external needing to sort of support that happiness or aid that happiness. Um, So Bimbisara, he's dependent upon all these different things, different varieties of sense pleasures. They're external, they're always transient. They always need topping up. So he's quite dependent, and the Buddha is completely independent. And there's a real freedom in that, that freedom of... and I'm sure you must know in yourselves times when perhaps being somewhere quite beautiful, so there's scenery, but actually you're quite content just to sit. Maybe that happens on retreat as well, when the some sort of that restless sort of desire to reach out for something to eat, something to listen to, something to watch, something to do, something to think about. It actually goes into abeyance, and it's just, okay, I'm just actually quite happy, just quite happy to sit, look at the view, not do anything, have a cup of tea. So there's a real simplicity in that. So there's a very interesting little teaching which I'm just going to mention because it's already popped up within those two stories, but it's the teaching of a relationship to pleasure and enjoyment. And it's the teaching of gratification, dangers, and release. There are these three aspects, and what we can tend to do around pleasure is hook into the ways in which they gratify us, they please us, and we like them, but not see or try to ignore the dangers or the drawbacks of those pleasures, those things that we like, and therefore the sense of release, freedom that the Buddha experiences, we don't get to see that. So I think with this practice of looking towards bringing awareness to look at moments of dukkha, moments of craving, we start to see much more clearly the two-sided nature of the things that we want, of craving. Subhuti puts it quite nicely. He says this about craving. He says, you take an object, for example, chocolate. You blow its pleasurable aspects out of proportion. You forget about its painful downside. You think by having that object, you'll secure your ego identity. You think by attaching yourself to the object, it will make you feel more secure, solid, and it'll enhance your ego identity. This is craving, the sense of us. It's adding something to us. So it can be very useful to in a way, there's the intoxication of pleasure. It's a bit like going on a ski run, isn't it? There's a sort of exhilaration or intoxication or enchantment. And what we can do is just look at the other side. Just say, okay, so yeah, there's this, the best salted caramel chocolate brownie in the world. I know where it is in Shrewsbury. I do. But, you know, the other side of it is currently spending quite a lot of money on my teeth because of the amount of sugar consumed. Well, no, it's not all that. Various conditions. But that's probably part of it. You know, and the extra weight it's going to put on. So, you know, maybe I have it, but be really clear about the downside and not so hooked into the only the more intoxicating side. So I'm getting near to the end. So I think sometimes it can be quite hard to connect with dukkha, especially if you feel like, well, everything's sort of all right, you know, I don't want to make a fuss, you know, actually things are fine, or maybe things are quite good. And that may well be the case. But there are little moments that you can just notice, little moments where there's a complaint with what's happening. So tuning into those. Sometimes I think to myself, okay, I feel okay, I feel all right. So maybe there isn't any sense of dukkha there. But it's a sort of all right mind state. It's not particularly, it's not very content or very happy. So what else is going on? What else can, so just taking an interest in what I can notice what. And sometimes just that noticing enables me to say, oh yeah, there's a little bit of discontent about something. And the noticing of that, if you like, helps to purify the mind by, in a way, acknowledging what else is there, acknowledging the dukkha that's there. So just by way of finishing off, really, this teaching of the gratification, the dangers or drawbacks, and the release. The release, I think, is really, really interesting. I feel like I'm just starting to explore it, really. But there's a sense of release from compulsion, a release from having to act on desires. And that's also a release then from constriction. Actually, something more opens up that sense of freedom from having a real choice about whether to act on a desire or not. There's a lovely quote by the teacher called Ajahn Brahm. He makes the distinction between freedom of desires, where we're free to have what we want, and freedom from desires. And that freedom from desires being a much greater freedom than this freedom of desires, which is dependent upon conditions. And sometimes the conditions will be there to support us having what we want, and at other times they will not be. So really it's in our interests to become more free, more independent from the habits of our wants and desires. So I've written here, I'm not sure if I'll be able to back it up, but what I've written, the spiritual life, if you like, it's not about getting a little bit nicer or a little bit kinder or a little bit wiser. It's actually really radical, a really radical waking up, a really radical vision. And so when... And I think sometimes I can get a taste of this, and I think of relating to desires, relating to wanting, relating to discomfort and not having things the way I want them. If I can, in the times when I can manage to relate to those things differently and have more equanimity around it, I get a flavour of that, the radical nature of the spiritual life. But what's also radical about it is it's not just about a flavour or a moment or a minute, but about that being a lived experience, an ongoing lived experience of freedom. So I want to just finish by reminding you of the reading. I think I read it in the first week, and it was to do with developing these four foundations of mindfulness, of which we've been looking at. So if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected: either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace or clinging left, non-returner. Let alone 7 years, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 2 years, for 1 year, let alone 1 year, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 1 month, for half a month, one of two fruits could be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone half a monk, sorry, half a month. If anyone should develop these four foundations in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. So it was with reference to this that it was said, bhikkhus, practitioners, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there we have it. That's the end of our Satipatthana arc. So I think let's have a cup of tea.